Welcome to the Product Podcast, brought to you by Product School. Here, you'll get fresh insight from the people at the very top of the tech companies who make the products we love. Remember, you can learn product management live online. Visit productschool.com to discover our new certificate path. There, you can also join the world's largest community of PMs and network with the leaders from these podcasts at our online events. There's something happening almost every day.
So I'd like to start by asking you, what attracted you to product management? Did you have any connections to the tech world when you were younger? Maybe like family, friends, or a family member?
Yeah, actually, both my parents were software engineers. So I'm a second generation software engineer myself. And I had a computer since the age of 3 or 4. And since I can remember myself, I had a computer to play around with. So it was a pretty clear career choice for me to get into tech itself. The transition from software engineering to product management happened a little later down the line. I think that was kind of when I was in my late 20s, when I realized that, building the right things is the more difficult thing for me. And I wanted to focus on kind of how we solve real user problems, as opposed to just how to build it.
So you're in quite a privileged position where most people in product or tech, you tell your parents what you do and they don't understand it, but your parents, like, they're on it.
Honestly, I think they understand what software engineering. I'm still not sure if they understand what is it that I do. They're like, so you tell her, you sit around and tell people what to build. I'm like, I don't quite tell people, but I try to convince people. This is the right thing to do.
That's all we can do. Talking more about your background, I noticed that you actually started out as a commander for the Israeli Defense Force, but in a kind of product management role. Could you like expand on that and just tell us more about what that was like?
Yeah, I mean, commander is probably like that is the official title, but I wasn't doing much commanding, as when you have a group of like brilliant kids, you don't command them what to do. Yeah. So again, it was more of a guiding and leadership type of thing. But I was in a software shop in the IDF, and I can't talk too much into the detail of what it was. It was an intelligence corps. But in the IDF, there wasn't this was an equivalent of maybe an engineering management / tech lead type of role. And the thing is that we did not have such a thing as a product manager in that role. And in fact, when I found out about it, I was like, huh, it's interesting that there is such a role that is separate from engineering manager. So as a team leader, I kind of did it all. I was an eng manager in some days. I was a product manager in some other days. Sometimes I was a program manager. And certainly there were some days, the most difficult ones, when I was a kind of like an HR representative in some days too.
Well, it's true what they say, product people wear a lot of hats.
It's true, yep.
Do you think starting out in a role like that, where you're doing so many different things at once, do you think that was helpful to you later in your product career, where you have to sort of, take one hat off and put another one on, so to speak?
For sure. And I think it was the thing that most helped was that I started out as like one of the team and as an engineer myself, and then leading the engineers and understanding their concerns day to day. So I would, speak to soldiers every week and understand truly what their concerns are when it comes to building great products. So I had a chance to understand sort of how the concerns of software engineers, day-to-day concerns of software engineers look like. And that gave me a lot of empathy to the engineers that I work with throughout my career.
Yeah, that's something that a lot of people say is really beneficial to them coming from an engineering background, is it's so much easier to direct people in the right way when you understand what their problems are, rather than just say, oh, I know this is an issue, but I know that you can get over it. It's like, it doesn't really work like that.
Yeah,
find a way to get the thing done. Like, that's not real leadership.
Yeah, and engineers often have concerns around like, oh, tech debt, like our code base is not doing well, and we have to do these things, and you have to be truly able to empathize and understand this and understand that, like, hey, software is inherently unpredictable, and try to work with engineering to make sure that you're trying to reduce uncertainty and create predictability for them as much as possible and offer them ways to accommodate their inherent unpredictability.
That must be really helpful for them. So going back to your educational background, I see that you've got quite an extensive educational history, as well as like you're an MBA and a master's in computer science. Do you feel that traditional education appropriately prepares people for a career in product, or is there still that need to seek extra education after going through the traditional routes?
So I would say that, first of all, I think it says in my bio, I'm done with formal education, I think, for the foreseeable future. At least formal education. My CS background definitely helped me establish myself as a credible peer to my programmer counterparts. So, you know, I think like the master's is probably a bit of an overkill. That was because I did that at a time where I thought that my career is going to be a CS professor, which I found out quite fast that that's not what I wanted to do. But it did be like the basic sort of bachelor's, and then the experience as a software developer gave me an insight into how the development process looks like. So that was very, very helpful. The MBA was interesting as it gave some frameworks and how to think about these some things. If somebody who's listening to this was going to do one or the two, I would say, hey, you should prioritize some CS background on this, just because it just is so helpful to build credibility. Honestly, I would say, though, that the best education you can get for product management is just to be one. Be one in a small startup, do a rotation, take on what is product management roles, just get your feet wet and learn on the job. So that's what I would recommend. And then I would say ongoing education, or I call like sharpening your saw, just generally getting out there and reading books and reading, listening to podcasts like these probably, but things of that nature is very helpful. Just, you know, I'm always surprised by how many people get into the PM craft without spending too much ongoing time, because we're busy day to day, very, very busy day to day. So it's hard to carve out the 2 hours a week to like, hey, I'm going to learn a little bit about this. I'm going to read a little bit about this. And there's actually plenty of good material out there. So just taking the time to do that, like self-learning, is very, very helpful.
Do you have any recommendations other than the product podcast, of course, for results that you could use?
Yeah, like there's a few books. One of them, inspired by Marty Kagan, is a really good one. The Mom Test by Rob Fitzpatrick is another really, really good one. I'll probably mention a couple. Brandon Chu of Shopify has a pretty good blog about how to think about like product manager sort of mental models and these type of things. So very helpful.
Oh, well, thank you for those recommendations. I'm going to add them to my list. I like Inspired by Marty Kagan. I'm with you on that. That's a good one. So you touched on it briefly just a second ago about how to transition from something like software engineering into product management. And correct me if I'm wrong, but you went through that transition while you were at Google when you started out as a software engineer. And did you make the transition to products while you were still at Google? Like your
transition like? I did. I started at Google, offers like a rotation program for software engineers to try on PM for like 6 to 9 months. And I did that to kind of feel what it was like, because coming in from the military, I, again, didn't know about the fact that there was such a thing called product manager, something that is distinct from an engineering manager. And I was like, oh, that looks cool. And I want to try what it was like. And it was a pretty big shock, to be honest. I really realized that I was really, even though I did those aspects back in the military, I was kind of ill-equipped to do it. As an example, there's a thing that we call influence without authority as a PM mantra, which is to say just recognition of the fact that you don't get to tell engineers what to do. You get to suggest and encourage and guide and convince, but you don't get to tell anything because you're not in a position of formal authority. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I wasn't really very good at that at the very beginning. And it took a couple of uh, a couple of hard lessons to learn that and to get into that. But so it was, I would say, kind of rough 6 months. And the very first 6 months was kind of rough, but also kind of cool.
Yeah, I think that's the best way. Well, that's what most people go through when they start a brand new job. It's like, this is cool, but it also kind of sucks. Like, starting new jobs is always terrible.
Those were crucible moments.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of transitions, I know that you've recently made the move to Airbnb. Congratulations on the new job. I hope it doesn't suck. So I just wanted to ask, what's your day-to-day look like now as an Airbnb product manager?
I would say that first of all, like a lot of the other Bay Area companies, right, most teams working from home, so that's obviously different. But the day-to-day, I would say, is pretty similar to Google. I work with engineers and designers to execute. I go through lots of user research to understand our users and kind of understand what they need. We pitch new ideas to leadership, et cetera, you know, try to get funding and these kind of things. So it's very, very similar to Google from that aspect. What's been different and really awesome is to observe just how much Airbnb sweats the details in terms of when it comes to design, especially. If Google's mantra is kind of, let's launch and iterate, let's put a product out there as quickly as possible, see how it goes and iterate based on that and look at the numbers mainly, then in Airbnb, there's a lot of pride in design and making sure that everything looks great, like top notch, from the copy to photography. All those aspects have to be really buttoned down, even for smaller scoped experiments and these type of things. And both approaches have their pros and cons, just kind of different.
Well, that sounds really cool. So speaking of launch, what's your product launch checklist? That's a question that bounces around the community a lot.
Yeah. So when you're coming to the launch point, that is, say, the sort of end work is ready, the code is ready, it's all built out and you're kind of ready to go, you've actually done most of your work. And there's a lot of like boxes to check, making sure that the UX does a walkthrough, making sure legal goes over it, PR, support, production capacity, these type of things. And the more established the company is, you're going to, like, these things are going to be mandated for you. So at Google, you know, there's literally a system that you have to go over and make sure all the boxes are ticked before you can proceed with the launch, just from a procedural perspective. So those are the things that you do, but even at a smaller company, you should probably do those things yourself. And yeah, I would say UX, legal, PR, support, production, these are all things that you should be checking. But those are the things that you may do when your product is ready to go, already implemented and all. It's kind of the last step in product delivery process. There's a lot of things that hopefully you do a lot before that, what we call product discovery, understanding your users and their needs, understanding the feasibility of this approach from an engineering perspective, from a business perspective, understanding your success metrics is something I find that a lot of product managers sort of will, you know, write down a POD or a proposal for a project without understanding, like, what is it that you're trying to actually achieve and why we should do this? And how will you know that we'll achieve what you are setting out to achieve? So for those things, again, touching on, inspired by Marty Kagan again, he does a really good job of like outlining those things. And somewhere in between sort of your discovery and your delivery phase, there should also be some amount of usability studies. People skip that pretty often. But in a usability study, is just taking your mocks that your designer made or you made, if you don't have a designer, and putting them in front of users who are, you know, not suspecting and don't, you know, they're not your friend, they're not your close friends, hopefully. They're ideally definitely not people who are working at your company, and just see how they work with it and see if the product is actually usable to them.
Do you get any like launch anxiety still? Because I know that a lot of people, when they're maybe a bit earlier on in their product career, when they're starting to launch things for the first time, there's the fear of like hitting that button and being like, yes, this is live. That's still a sensation for you?
I don't know if I would call it anxiety. I would call it, there's an adrenaline, there's a rush. For sure, because you're about to expose yourself to the world. The reality is, I think there's a less and less debt as the time you just kind of grow a little numb to it and becomes more operational. And truth be told, the way that I combat that is say, hey, people, you know, most people won't actually notice your launch, or they will not notice that you pushed out a new version. A lot of things, because, you know, you spend 50, 60 hours a week thinking about this product. You think it's the most important thing in the world. For most people, it goes under your radar. Like, oh yeah, they made some changes. So I would say just this sense of, hey, we're not as important as we might feel is a good way to combat that anxiety.
Yeah, it's actually a weirdly nice way to think about it. Like, you know what, if this goes wrong, it's not gonna finish the world off.
And you should be always ready to like roll back, and good engineering teams will have sort of these mechanisms ready to pull back at a moment's notice. So that's kind of like your protection from a downside, where you're just rolling it back. But I would say, again, you know, for a majority of cases, it would be a good problem to have it. Like, oh my God, too many people paid the launch, and there was something that was something small that didn't go well, and you'll have an opportunity.
Yeah, I guess a lot of people would have a backup plan for when things go wrong. So, well, speaking of backup plans, like, has that been something that you've encountered at some point where you've, maybe not during a launch, but where you've done something and it's gone wrong and you had to like fall back on a backup plan?
I mean, like, that happens probably in every launch. There's a chance, like, I rolled back many launches, like, you know, just launching something and something spikes in a way that we don't expect, and you roll back, and that's a very easy backup mechanism. But there were a lot of harder backup cases where essentially we were under a timeline where we wanted to deliver a certain product in a certain way, and then due to technical constraints, actually we were not able to do it, and we would have to come up with a backup plan of what to. So it wasn't that the backup plan got activated after the launch, but rather before the launch. So you know, we wanted to implement in a certain way, but we realized that from a technical perspective, that was not going to be possible. So we had to change the way we implemented it in a way that frankly hurt the user experience. But as a product manager, actually, you're asked to make these trade-offs by engineering quite often. So, like, this is a very common occurrence that you will say, hey, this experience, and we have a date we're going to launch for, and engineers are going to come and say, maybe, hopefully a month before the launch, but maybe sometimes 2 weeks before the launch or a week before the launch, like, hey, we have a problem. We can't do it the way that you wanted. And now you have to sit down and figure out what your options are. And you know, one option might be to delay the launch. Another option might be to find a way that compromises. And you got to get creative. And that's where it helps to understand their concerns. You got to get creative. You got to understand what it is that they can do. You got to probe nicely. And what doesn't work is say, no, launch just with the original scope at the original time. So like, those kind of things happen in any launch, pretty much.
I guess a certain level of flexibility and being
exactly
on the fly is just part of the job. You just gotta, doesn't mean you're a bad PM if these hurdles come up. It's just the thing.
And oftentimes the answer is to just delay the launch. And I know a lot of product managers feel pretty negative about it, delaying a launch, but sometimes that is the right answer. And if you don't want to compromise your product, because you're ultimately, sometimes people will have leadership pressure to launch in a certain timeline, but ultimately you are responsible. You're the captain of this ship. You're responsible for the product that comes out. And if something flops in a really bad way, and then it won't help to say, oh, my leadership pressed me to launch this. You are accountable for it.
You can't pass the buck every time.
And there were times certainly where I said, oh, this big launch that we're trying to do, I'm gonna hold it off for another month because we are not ready. And it takes a lot to come to leadership and say, oh, we're gonna delay this launch by a month because it's the right thing. but you know, it's all at the same time, it buys credibility with your engineers, with your designers, with your team, and kind of you are the person of the product team who's supposed to do this, to come and say, hey, we're not ready with the product. I can't, in good conscience, launch this and be proud of this. And it's generally it works with good leadership teams.
And I suppose that's what it's all about, is trying to launch things that we're proud of. I mean, things that work and things that look beautiful as well, but mostly things that we can be proud of.
Yep.
Yeah, so you touched upon, what did you call it? Sharpening the saw, or sharpening your
saw? Sharpening your saw, yeah.
Great phrase. I'm going to use that from now on. So what sort of, like, how are you hoping to sharpen your saw? Like, what skills are you hoping to maybe, like, gain new skills, or, yeah, sharpen the ones you've already got? What have you got planned?
For myself, I think one of the things that I'm trying to do specifically is learn how to manage a portfolio of products. My nature is that I get excited about every single thing we can do. I just see opportunity everywhere, and I get excited about every single thing. And it's just like I have a bias for action, and I just want to say yes and yes and yes to everything. And it's really hard for me to say no, just due to excitement. It's kind of like it's a product FOMO, if you can call it that.
Yeah.
So my goal for this year is actually to say more no's and be much more deliberate about what I undertake. If not for my own sake, then for my engineer's sake, because you don't want to be sort of peanut buttering your resources. You want to be kind of focused on what are the top three things that you're trying to do, and be able to say, like, oh, these other seven things we are not going to do.
How are you able to do that? Do you have like a process for working out which are the things you should say yes to, which things you should say no to?
I mean, it's a very loose process, but I would say generally what I try to start with is start with a sort of with a high level vision of where is the, like, how the world should look like in 2-3 years, if sort of we had a magic wand and we had all the engineering resources that we wanted, what is the absolute ideal situation of the world in 2-3 years? And usually a utopian and unachievable one in that, but like, what does that look like? And then from there on, like, try to draw what are like the specific objectives for the next like 12 to 18 months. What are we trying to do? Which of this can actually be a realistic goal for us? And then I try to like look at the activities that we could do, and generally the activities we could do is actually usually the easiest part. People like usually have a backlog of projects or backlog of ideas, and they're hopefully coming from everywhere in the organization: engineering, UX, business development, all those areas. And you try to sort of prioritize your backlog in the light of your business objectives. And the thing is, you should be flexible on the activities, but less flexible on the business objectives. So business objectives should kind of last you for the like 12 to 18 month window, whereas your activity should feel free to change it on a quarter to quarter, sometimes month to month, or even week to week basis. If you find that, like, hey, we thought that implementing feature X would help us drive like 10% more users, but actually, now that we tested out a little bit, we don't believe that actually is true anymore. So if my objective is to grow my user base by 10%, then like I'm going to scrap this activity in the V2 of this feature, and I'm going to do this other thing instead.
That's really excellent advice, keeping aligned to one thing like the whole way along the year. That's like the important things. That's really good advice. I've also heard that as career advice, when people say, okay, think about what your ideal job and what your ideal life looks like 2, 3, 5, whatever, 10 years from now, and then make sure that your next steps are like, okay, what's going to get me towards that ideal? Because you might not ever be an astronaut, but
yeah,
if that's the ideal, that's the arena that you want to work in, what steps can you take to get as close to that arena as possible? I don't know, maybe people listening are going to be astronauts, and I wish them all the best in the world. So moving on to a bit of a different track. So you're currently in San Francisco, is that right?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, and you're one of the people who moved to San Francisco for work. And I know that as it's one of the really, you know, it's almost the tech and product hub in the world, there are a lot of people who either have an eye on moving to San Francisco or that's something they're actively planning on. Can you give us like an insider's view on what it's like to relocate to San Francisco for work?
It's expensive. Yeah. I would say it's very expensive. Yeah, we moved here in 2013. It was a little less expensive, but not by much, Alan, actually. I would say San Francisco is culturally a very unique place. So it's also going to depend very highly on where you come from. I come from Israel, and we have a very different culture. So it's kind of hard for me to untangle what is San Francisco, what is California, what is American. But there were a lot of adjustments for me. For starters, there is a nice overdose. Everybody always smiles. Everybody's extremely nice. And everybody's like, oh, yeah, we should do this, we should do that. But it's for me, it's kind of, it was at the beginning, at least, it was kind of hard to tell what they're thinking. So that was one challenging part. And then everyone talks about tech, like, all the time. So if you're, like, living in London, you might have, like, banker friends, you might have lawyer friends, you might have doctor friends. Here, like 80% of your friends are going to be somehow attached to tech. Mm-hmm. So it's a bubble, and you have to kind of be mindful of that and be mindful of, like, this is not how the rest of the world thinks. Mm-hmm. Because it creates some challenges in doing your work. If your whole worldview is shaped by San Francisco, by the SF bubble, then it's pretty challenging. In fact, in some product teams that I had, we would go and we would really make a good effort to do research outside of San Francisco, even drive up to like Sacramento or take a short flight to like Phoenix, Arizona, just to like meet normal people, meet real people. But I would say that you will feel welcome in San Francisco. It is a very welcoming place. So if you're on the fence, I would say come. You might get sick out of it after a couple of years, but I think, you know, most people will be glad that they came.
I have some friends here from San Francisco, and it is all they talk about is San Francisco. And every now and then you have to say to them, like, I'm sorry, where are you from again? I don't think you mentioned it in the last 5 minutes. So they'll tell you
about their paleo, keto, vegan diet, and their intermittent fasting, their shoes. And all these things are true.
Yeah, I can't wait to visit. I'm very excited. sounds like my kind of place. So changing topic again, this is a question we like to ask all of our podcast guests, and it's really interesting to hear the different perspectives on it. What would your advice be for a brand new product manager? Let's say it's maybe they've worked in tech before, but this is their first product manager job. What should they do in their first 30 days as a brand new baby product manager?
Oh, yeah. It's a really good question. And I think it's a good question for PMs to think about their first 30 days in any role, not just when they're a baby product manager, but then as they transition from team to team. So this applies there as well. So I would say three things. Meet people, listen, and ask how you can help. And it all ties back to the fact that as a PM, you don't carry a lot of formal authority. Your only source of authority is your credibility. So if people don't, you know, buy into what you're saying, then what you're saying is not going to happen. So and credibility is earned, it's not given. So I would say that the first thing is like touching on meet people, listen how you can help. Meet people is your kind of first of all, to establish relationships. Just go for a meet and greet with everybody that you're about to work, and don't even talk about work. Just talk about like your background, their background, establish that basic human connection. And it's really important because when you have to later ask for a favor, and you will have to ask for a favor at some point because all you're doing is asking for favors, you have an established relationship to work with. And I heard this quote from the book called The First 90 Days. And they say, hey, you don't want to meet your neighbors for the first time when your house is on fire. So you want to get just that meeting out of the way with everyone pretty much. Mm-hmm. The second thing would be to listen. And it's sometimes hard for PMs to stay and listen because you obviously have a lot of ideas. That's why you were hired as a PM. You have good thoughts about how the business, where the business should go. But try to tune that out a little bit and try to listen, like actively listen, especially in the first 30 days, because you don't have that credibility yet. So when you join a company, you don't really know anything, right? So you listen, you probe, understand what people are telling you, try to do active listening, just not thinking about your reply, but really try to soak in what the people are saying. Not only that, it will give you an understanding of what's happening around the company or around your product, but it'll also buy some credibility for you as people will feel heard, like, okay, you know, this and so and so PM is actually listened to us before coming up with all these ideas. And a third thing I would say is ask how you can help. It's a simple but a really great way to gain knowledge and credibility. It's really, I would say, so it's kind of like the flip coin of listening. So I would, it's a pretty simple thing to say, like, hey, it could be something as simple as, hey, we need you to talk to legal to unblock this thing. And it might not be something that you're particularly adept or even necessarily very fun, but it's very, very important because A, it will establish your willingness to do whatever it takes. B, you'll learn while you're contributing just like the best way possible because you're productive from day one. And C, it gets you some points in what I call the bank account with every one of your counterparts. So that when you need something, you're like, oh, so and so helped me with that other thing. So I already like him a little bit.
Do you think that the role, like the product manager role, would change fundamentally if you were given some sort of formal authority? Like if like yeah, someone waved that magic wand and said, okay, you are now allowed to tell people what to do. Would it make life easier or would some of the magic be lost, do you think?
I think the magic would be lost in a lot of ways because you do need a strong engineering leadership in order to sort of to focus. Like these are two different aspects of how you build it the right way and how you develop the careers of the engineers. Whereas as a PM, you're really trying to focus on the business. So it's I would say that it should be separate. I wouldn't have it any other way.
That's a really good answer, and I'm glad that's the answer you gave, and there wasn't like a sort of megalomaniac grasp for power there. Like, yes, the authority.
No. It's like the best product teams that I've seen is are have a strong engineering leader, a strong product leader that are in sort of like a mind meld situation, and they trust each other to, you know, like the product person trusts the engineering person to give honest and good assessments on what it is that we can and we can't and we should and we shouldn't do. And similarly, it goes kind of both ways. So that those are the best things I've seen. And a dictator PM is not a good PM.
No, that's not a good look. Okay, well, I'm gonna let you get back to your very busy day shortly. This has been an absolute pleasure. I think we've got some really
Same
great
here.
insights here. I just want to ask you one final question, and it's a doozy. But what is the greatest lesson product management has ever taught you? That's the exact noise everyone makes with the question.
it's I mean, like trying to think sort of like what are things that I've taken not just to my day-to-day work, but also sort of taking with me to the rest of my or the other aspects of my life. I think it's really the understanding of your audience. So as an example, if you're a software engineer and you write like a design doc and some other engineer and understand something in it and asks a question. And if it's in the doc and you point to them like, oh, here it is in the doc and it was there. And then you were sort of right as an engineer because you know it was kind of there. And there's an abbreviation, it's called the RTFM, like read the effing manual. And it's sort of it talks to the nature of how we see things in engineering, which is like it is the reader's responsibility to understand the material, or it's and it translates to a lot of things. Like it translates in product. Oh, the button is there. The user just didn't figure it out. It's the user's problem. And when you switch to PM, it doesn't work like that. If somebody doesn't notice something in your doc, it's your fault. The doc gets evaluated in the reader's eyes, and your pitch gets evaluated in your leader's eyes. There isn't such a thing as objectively good pitch. The pitch only works if your leaders like it. Your product is only good if the users like it. There is the ultimate test, and it doesn't matter if you had all the features and the user just didn't know. So you really have to empathize with your audience, really hone your thoughts enough to build something compelling, be that a doc, a pitch deck, or a product. And it's a simple concept, but it's actually quite powerful in how applicable it is across not just your day-to-day work, but also various parts of your life. Just kind of like understanding that everything gets evaluated in the eyes and ears of your audience. It's a pretty good insight.
Love that. I couldn't have picked a better note to end on. That was fantastic advice.
Thank you for listening to the Product Podcast. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave a review on iTunes. For more product insights, head over to productschool.com.